Hi team, Kate here. I'm doing my first solo podcast. The reason for this is, for one, Sean's in for his hip surgery. And second of all, we spoke to Sally Friedman, who's an absolutely incredible human being. She's worked on huge brands like UEFA, the 2018 Commonwealth Games, and the 2015 Asian Cup. We spoke to her about sexism and misogyny in football management. So it was an absolutely fantastic chat. I'm really excited for you to hear this one. You can get her book now. It's called Get Your Tits Out for the Lads. It's a fantastic read. It's quite light. I highly recommend it. Also, let us know what you think of this podcast. Please drop us a review or a message. I'd love to hear what you think of my solo one, whether you'd like more or less of me, more or less of the boys, and hope you enjoy.
I'm James Beatty.
And I'm Sean Carroll.
And welcome to the Rebuild Health and Fitness podcast.
How do you want to start it?
We'll just say
welcome.
Okay, welcome everyone to the Rebuild Health and Fitness podcast. We are very excited to have Sally Friedman on today. Sally is, as James has said, this is a perspective from an intelligent and ambitious woman. Sally's an accomplished professional in the world of sport. She received the only full academic scholarship to study a master's in business and sport management at Griffith University. Since graduating, Sally's worked at the Melbourne City Football Club, Wellington Phoenix Football Club, the 2015 Asian Cup, the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games, and has worked in different areas including marketing, communication, fan engagement, protocol ticketing, and spectator services. And most recently has released her incredible book, Get Your Tits Out for the Lads, which we will talk about a bit later. Sally, how are you?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm well. I'm in Australia. I've been here almost 2 weeks now, I think. I've had a week in Perth and I'm currently in Sydney. So enjoying the winter here. It's beautiful.
And you're at the Football Writers Festival. And are you having much to do with the FIFA World Cup at the moment?
Well, it kicks off tonight, so I'm very excited for it to start. And you're right. I was here the last 3 days in Sydney. We've had an incredible 3 days for the Football Writers Festival, where I was fortunate enough to be involved to talk about my book and also some of the challenges around diversity in football. So that was an incredible few days, just as we get ready for the World Cup to kick off this evening.
And can you talk a bit, because your book came out last month, can you talk a bit about what, in your own words, what it's about and what the kind of target of this kind of thing is?
Sure. So it's a memoir. It's a true story about my life as a woman working in a male-dominated world of football. So as you touched on in your introduction, I worked in several different football clubs in Australia. I worked for the Federation for Football Australia, worked at the Asian Cup, and most recently in Switzerland, I worked for UEFA, which is the European governing body for football. So unfortunately, sexism was a common theme throughout all of those positions. And it got to the point where I thought, you know what, I've got enough stories for a book here. And writing's in my DNA. I love it. And I decided to put pen to paper, or more often than not, hammer the keyboard on my laptop. And that's what drove me to publish the book, which, as you said, came out only a couple of weeks ago.
And have you always had a passion for sport? Did you always want to work in the space?
I've loved sport since I was a young child. Football has been my favorite sport growing up. So yes, I think I've always had a passion for sport. That's why I chose to study a master's in it at Griffith University. And football was, in, again, a bit like writing. It's in my DNA. I love it. I'm very passionate about the power of sport in general, but specifically football. I really do believe it's the beautiful game and I love it more than most things.
You spoke in your book about being a young girl and being told you weren't allowed to play, that football was for boys. How did that feel, being a child and now where you are? It's a huge accomplishment, I think, because most women, or all women, I'm sure, can relate to being sidelined in a sporting arena.
Yeah, I still have the vivid memory of asking my PE teacher if I could play football like the boys. We, believe it or not, had a girl side and a boy side of the playground at school, at junior school. And the boys were allowed to play football at break times on their side of the playground. So I really wanted to go and play football with the boys. And when I asked my PE teacher if I could play, I was firmly told no, that I could only play hockey or netball. Because football was for boys. But the little rebel that Sally was and still is at that age said, well, sorry, Mr. Teacher, I'm going to go and play football. And I went across to the boys' side of the playground, and the dinner lady on duty punished me. She told me to stand on the line because I'd broken two rules. One, I was on the boys' side of the playground, and two, I was playing football. And I cried my eyes out standing on this line and just thought, even at 7 years old, I understood that that was not fair. How is that fair? I am at school. The boys can play football. I cannot. It made no sense to me whatsoever. And it wasn't until the age of 23 that I first got the opportunity to play football. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because sexism, sadly, is still day in, day out, a part of our society that we're living in. And I had to try and do something about it with my small skill set that I have, which is writing. And that's why I decided to try and shine a light on the topic, because so often it's brushed under the carpet, and I thought a book might give me a little bit more of a platform to talk about it.
I was reading your book, and right at the beginning in the introduction, you talk about these comments people make. You're going to struggle in a man's world. Sally, you're going to need to be very tough. Are you sure you can cope? Be careful. You'll need to be very resilient and very strong. And you say you dismiss these concerns. And then later on you say, looking back, they were right and I was wrong, very wrong. I think that really must resonate and with a lot of women, and that feeling of those naysayers, and then to have the confidence to go, you know what, they were right, but you still are where you are, is so impressive.
Thank you very much. Yes. Sadly, a lot of friends and family did warn me before I started working in the male-dominated world of football that I would, like some of those comments you read were just some of them that I received. But I vividly again remember, Sally, are you sure? Do you really want to do this? There's male pal dinosaurs at the top. Even though you know lots about football, you're going to struggle. And I was strong, independent, young, resilient woman going, I'll be fine. What are you talking about? I was very naive. And I didn't want to believe that they were right. I was like, no, that's not the real world. Surely it's got better by now. That was 1950. The world's moved on since then, but sometimes it still feels like we're in 1950.
I bet. I even saw you tweeted about the FIFA World Cup, and it's all you said it's Women's World Cup, yet here is our all singing, all dancing male commentary team. And that's now.
Yeah, that's every time we make a tiny step forward and I think, oh, we're on our way to equality, equity, we're getting there. And then you're reminded very quickly, almost daily, why we're nowhere near where we should be. And as you rightly say, today, there was an all-male commentary team proudly posted all over Twitter for every stadium of the World Cup and all the matches they'll be covering. And really, this is 2023. Don't tell me that there aren't world-class female commentators out there. They might be a bit harder to find. They might not have been given the same opportunity as men, but they are there, and you might have to work a little bit harder to recruit them, to put them on air. But this is the Women's World Cup. The Women's World Cup. The clue is in the title. We shouldn't have to call it the Women's World Cup, because, hey, guess what? The Men's World Cup is just called the World Cup. But yeah, it things like that break my heart. As I say, sometimes you think you're making progress, and then you're reminded very quickly that no, we're nowhere near equality.
Do you think we're moving in the right, I guess we are moving in the right direction, even having these conversations now, but do you think we're moving there fast enough, or what would you like to see more of in that space?
Yes, we are moving in the right direction. It's refreshing, particularly in England, to see a lot more females in media, a lot more headlines are dominated by female women's sport. When England football team won Women's Euro last summer, it rightly dominated every single front page, every single TV headline. So even if you weren't following football, you weren't interested in football, it would be very hard to have not seen that on the day that women won the grand final. I'm talking like I'm in Australia now, won the final of Women's Euro. So that was really incredible. And there are signs, as I say, sometimes where I think finally progress is being made, but it's too slow and it's too little and it's too little too late, because it's on the backdrop of 50 to 100 years of inequality. So yes, it's great that we're putting women in the spotlight here in Australia too, with the AFL, the rugby, you know, women's sport is taking off. It's rising at a rapid rate. But why is it only recently? Why did it take a trophy in England for everyone to stand up and notice the women's football team? You know, if England could have easily not won that competition, and then there would have been no fanfare. It shouldn't take success for people to stand up and start talking about the women's wonderful athletes, but it took a trophy for everyone to go, oh, wow, women's football's quite good. So I think it is moving in the right direction, but I think we need to increase the pace and make that gap less. For example, the FIFA Women's World Cup, the prize for the women is $110 million. For the men that just won in Qatar, they got over $400 million. So the women are getting approximately a quarter of what the men are getting. And that for me is too much, too wide. And yes, the women's prize pool has trebled, but the gap is still enormous. So it's not fair. It's not equal. The winning team have won the World Cup, like the men's team won the World Cup, yet they get paid a quarter.
What are some of the things in your experience, because you've got this huge resume, are there systems that you implemented, or were there certain milestones that you experienced throughout your career in those different sporting bodies that were those moves in the right direction?
I tried my best to speak up and try and implement, I guess, projects that would try and affect change and move us in the right direction. Towards the end at UEFA, when I got so frustrated with the accumulation effect of so many instances of sexism, I was integral in setting up a gender equality working staff group, where I put out a call to action to all staff in the organization to meet regularly and to discuss some initiatives that we could put in place with the support of the human resource department to try and instigate change. And I really wanted men to be part of that working group too, because as I say in my book, I'm not blaming men throughout all of these instances where sexism has dominated my career. I don't blame them. We're living in a world of gendered stereotypes, and sometimes they're just not aware and they don't know, or it's unconscious bias. They're not even doing things on purpose, but by educating them and opening their eyes to some of the things we experience as a woman, it can really help them understand. So that's why I wanted men to be part of the working group too. But unsurprisingly, it was dominated by females, this working group. So it was still good, and it was a step in the right direction. And we did implement several things that towards gender equality. But as I say, it just felt like it was nothing to balance out the inequality. But it's baby steps. But I want us to sprint a bit faster rather than jog at snail pace.
Fair. And someone's going to be the driver behind that. I think every organization needs that hero to be driving the force and getting the momentum. And you're always going to have those people that aren't on board. So it's good to have that passion and fire, because if you don't have that, it's like, if you don't do it, who's going to do it, particularly in that male dominated space?
Exactly. And I think by, you know, someone speaking up and saying, and challenging the norm that, well, Sally, 100 men applied for this position, so no wonder we hired a man. Oh, if you have that attitude, nothing's ever going to change. Why don't we try and look for some women? Are you advertising on websites where women look? Have you looked internally? Are there any women that potentially could be encouraged to apply for the position and be promoted into the position? Are they encouraged to look for senior roles, not just accept, well, 100 men applied? It's a bit like this commentary argument. Yeah, all the guys are on Visible. They're out there every day commentating on everything. So the people making the decisions can easily see them, easily pick them and say, he's good, he's great, he knows football, hire him, job done. It's taken me 10 minutes, secured all the contracts. Hiring women might have taken them a week to find the right person, or a little bit harder. So it's the lazy, easy option. And I don't want people to be lazy and easy. I want people to do the hard work to try and close this gap.
So something I feel conflicted about is quotas. I feel like a quota can mitigate my own achievements. And one of my roles is there's six people doing the job and I'm the only female. And so I'd be really pissed off if I was hired not on my merit but on my gender. But how do you feel? Because I still think quotas are important. I just don't know. I think they're a step, but then the next step, like there's so many more steps after that. What are your opinions on quotas? Do we need them? Are they effective, or do you think they mitigate women's achievements?
I'm with you. I'm not a fan of them. I think the best person should be hired for the job regardless of gender. But what I think needs to change is making sure that you educate the panel that are in charge of recruitment to try and reduce their bias. We're all humans. I have bias. You have bias. We hire like-minded people. We need to try and educate people to see that, to try and think differently, to have balance on the panel so that people think differently and see things differently. And then, as I say, if you have 100 men apply for a position, don't do the interviews until you've at least got some women that you can interview too. I'm not saying the woman should get the job, but in that interview process, interview two women and two men and give the best person the job. If you interview four men, what's going to happen? A man's going to get the job. So that's where I think we can change, is actually the process before. Because as I said, that's quite often quoted as an excuse. Well, only men applied, so that's why they've got the job. So we need to go back and fix cultures as well, so that when women are given a job, they are supported in an environment where sexism doesn't happen, so that they can see success and they are not going to walk out. I read the other day, I think Adidas' final remaining senior female executive quit. So they now have no female senior staff at another sporting organization. And that's replicated across many sporting organizations, that even when they've done this quota job, oh, look at us, we've got 40% women, aren't we wonderful? 2 years later, they're not there anymore. Because guess what? Misogyny, sexism, and gender inequality has driven them out, perhaps. I don't know for sure all the reasons why women left, but at an educated guess, I would think that that's played a part in their decision to leave the organization.
It kind of comes back to that, for me, it comes back to that point of, like, if a man is passionate, because I'm very passionate about my job and I get heated and I get called emotional, whereas men get called passionate or guns. And it's just language like that really pisses me off in the workplace, because I'm passionate about my job and I'm speaking the same way a man would. But in that instance, I'm emotional and it's a bit like, oh, we don't know about her.
Exactly. Spot on again. I've got a little segment in my book, and I think the title is Language Matters, because you're so right. You know, women speak up and be resilient and be strong, and we're suddenly emotional and shut up, you're just a feminist or whatever it might be. Yeah,
or you're a ball buster if you're not emotional, or ball breaker.
Exactly. We're too aggressive, where a guy is assertive and wonderful and knows his worth, and we're just piping up like a crying woman or whatever it might be that they label us. So language is really important. And that's when I said education can play a part. Because again, these are just terms that we hear day in, day out, and it's a slip of the tongue. It's not necessarily that they mean it or they even understand the words they're using are sexist. So that's where I think education can play a part in changing the culture of these organizations and teaching people and media and everything that we read online that language matters. It really does matter. And as the example I gave, the Women's World Cup, the Women's Champions League, the women, whatever it might be, men don't have their gender in the title. But I can watch the Women's World Cup. I know they're women playing on the field. You don't need to tell me, hey, this is women's football, everyone. But we do, because men stole the headlines. They got the first event. They are the World Cup and we are the Women's World Cup.
Do you think I'm infatuated by this phenomenon that is the Matildas, because they're more popular than the Socceroos and they don't have the women's connotation, like everyone calls them the Tillies and watches the Tillies play, and they don't seem to have the same holdbacks that and hurdles and obstacles. I'm sure they do have them, but the public perception of them is quite different. Do you have any insight into why they are positioned at, on par in terms of the public sphere to the Socceroos? If not more, I would say they're better known. Working my side job as ABC and working there, the public interest and audience engagement with the Tillies is above and beyond the Socceroos.
Probably comes down to a little bit of, and it shouldn't, but success. You know, the men are competing in world men's football. It's very, very, very tough. And the Australia aren't known as one of the good teams, unfortunately, in when you talk about world men's football on the global scale. You know, it's the European teams and the South American teams that dominate, that win the World Cup. Whereas Australia, the women's and the Matildas are good. They are a very good competitive side. So I think that might be one of the reasons that elevates their profile a little bit. And I think, as we know, in Australia, there's so much competition with football, although it's the biggest sport in the planet. In Australia, sadly, it isn't. We have AFL, we have rugby, we have cricket, and then we have soccer, or football, as I call it. I think that plays even more true when we talk about men's sport than it does when we talk about women's sport in Australia. So potentially, I think that there are a couple of the reasons. I don't know. I haven't got any research. I haven't done any research myself, and I haven't been in Australia for the last 5 years, so I'm a little bit removed to have an expert answer on that. But there's just some of my guesses as to why maybe the Matildas are followed more passionately than the Socceroos. And I think a World Cup on home soil as well. Obviously, over the last couple of years, everyone is getting excited and they've got a decent chance to win the whole thing. Whereas, no disrespect to the men's team, but if Australia were hosting the men's World Cup, which we all know didn't happen when they tried to bid for it, we won't go there, that's a conversation for another day, but there wouldn't be that same excitement and buzz about Australia's men winning the World Cup. It would be very unlikely, even if it was on home soil, that the men would win it. So potentially that's why there's more admiration for the Matildas.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of a bigger fish in a smaller pond, because it's a different code. And yeah, sure, we have so many sports that we support, and it has, yeah, the Tillies have been around for a long time and they are successful in comparison. I guess the Socceroos not so much.
Yeah.
Which exactly is not insulting to say. And we don't deserve the World Cup. If we call it soccer and not football, then I don't think we deserve the World Cups for the, like, the big ones.
The
men's. Yeah.
Well, don't call it the big ones. This Women's World Cup is massive, sorry, enormous.
Yeah.
No, that's all right.
And it's great to see the uptake. It's fantastic to see. I've got a lot of friends and family who the Matildas games are sold out and they're trying to get tickets to different ones. And so it's fantastic to see that enthusiasm for it, because it's nice, you know. Soccer's always, or football's always struggled in Australia comparatively. So to see that appetite growing is really impressive.
Yeah, I'm really excited too. I'm lucky enough to be going to the match here in Sydney on Thursday, the opening one in Australia. But interestingly, at the Football Writers Festival, one of the sessions was about, there was a debate and there was a team that was saying that the Women's World Cup would leave a legacy and it would kickstart, you know, an explosion of women and girls football and it would be brilliant for Australia. And they were four, you know, creating an argument around that. And then there was a team of four panelists or five panelists that argued against it, saying that it would just be like the Asian Cup. Remember, in 2015, the men won the Asian Cup on home soil. And where's the legacy from that? There was none. I was in Australia at the time working on that event, and it was incredible. The men won, and there was so much hype around it. And I was actually a coach at University of Queensland Football Club at that time. And as a result of the men winning the Asian Cup, hey, guess what? Loads of young boys and girls wanted to suddenly start playing football. But we had to turn them all away. Because, hey, guess what? We didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have the facilities. We didn't have the space. We didn't have the resources. And this was one of the richest, biggest football clubs in Brisbane. But we couldn't accept all these young kids that wanted to play football. So my worry is that even if the Matildas are extremely successful and they win the whole thing, is that legacy, is there enough people behind it? Is there enough funding? Is there enough infrastructure to really change it, or are we just riding a wave and having a good party for 2-4 weeks and then it goes back to number 4, number 5, number 6 in the headlines?
It's always a good step in the right direction though, right? I'm a huge basketball fan, and to have the FIBA World Cup, I was obsessed. And I think had I, being a child, I played basketball in my teenage years, but not as a child. And had I seen people like Lauren Jackson growing up and knowing that that was even a career option, I think I would have had a very different attitude and relationship to the sport. And I still play and I love it. And by no means would I have been professional. I'm 5'5" and clumsy, but it's having those role models, right, to look up to. And you weren't even allowed to play football as a child, let alone have people in a public space that you, and role models that you could look up to. So there is shifts there. I think it's just generations upon generations to get there.
Oh, you're absolutely spot on. And although I sound quite pessimistic, I am optimistic, and I try to get this across to some of the people that I've been chatting to over the last few days, because it's not, although my book's quite a heavy read and it shines a light on some sad stories, I do still have optimism. And the amount of times I'm reminded of the horrible sexism, like we talked about at the beginning today on the podcast about the all-male commentating team, I have stories that bring happiness about football to me every day as well. On the flight here from Perth to Sydney, there were two young boys sitting across the aisle from me, I guess 6 or 7 years old. They had the Women's World Cup sticker album, and they did not shut up for 3.5 hours from takeoff to landing about Steph Catley, Sam Kerr, swap you this, swap you that. And it was brilliant. These young boys were looking at female footballers for 3.5 hours and talking about them. I didn't have a female Women's World Cup. Sorry, I didn't have a Women's World Cup sticker album when I was 6 or 7. It didn't exist. I've got Italia 90 on my bookshelf, the Men's World Cup. That was the first sticker album I ever had. And I grew up thinking only men and boys played football because that's all I saw. Whereas, you know, what you talked about basketball is true. These young boys are growing up watching women playing football in a World Cup, and they'll probably keep this sticker album on their shelf until they're adults and go, maybe that's the first sticker album they ever had. And that's hugely important, because you have to see it to be it.
And can you talk a bit about the experiences you've had? Maybe is there any examples of that stand out for you of that sexism in your career?
Yes, there's a lot in the book. There's a lot of anecdotes that I go into, mainly things that have been said to me. One example I can think of off the top of my head was about being a female and trying to use the toilet. I mean, how I can't, when I say this, it sounds ridiculous, but this happened and it's still happening today. So as a female working at a stadium, my job was to be there, to film some players, to do some social media, to do a few interviews, and then go home. On arrival at the stadium, I needed to use the bathroom, and I went to the female toilet, and it was locked. So I asked the facilities manager if he could please open the female toilet. And he said to me, "You can just use the men's. The changing rooms are open."
Lovely.
And I said, "Pardon?" He said, "You can just use the men's." And at this point, the boys, the professional players, were in there getting changed. The toilets he were referring to were past where the boys were getting changed. I would have had to walk through a changing room, go to an open plan urinal area to find a cubicle to then go to the toilet, because that's not awkward at all. So I kind of was a bit stunned, and still, like, I don't normally lose it in a work environment. I'm very calm, very professional. And I asked him for a third time, "Can you please open the female toilet?" "No, Sally, that will cost me time and money to clean." So at that point, I did very sarcastically, admittedly, say, "Well, I'm pretty sure if I go and follow your lackadaisical instructions and use the male toilets, my used sanitary towel down the toilet, because last time I checked, men's toilets don't have sanitary bins, is going to cost you a lot more time and money to clean. So for the fourth time, can you please open the female toilets? And by the way, I'm going to be here every pre-match day -1 for training. And so next week, please make sure this bathroom is open."
Well done.
And Thank you. But why should I have to fight to be able to use a toilet, for goodness sake? And he went off and trampled away angrily. 10 minutes later, reluctantly opened the bathroom as though I'd asked him to do like something that was such an inconvenience and made me feel invisible. And hey, guess what? The following week, when I was back at training to do the filming, what happened? I went to open the bathroom door and, you know, it was locked. So that's just one example that's highlighted in my book, but I won't reveal too many more, otherwise people won't buy the book.
It's a fantastic read, and I'm only a few chapters in, but it's really, for such a heavy topic, it's really easy to read, and I think that's so important. It's like, you know, it's just, I can relate to a lot of it. What I can't relate to is, well, maybe I can, the title, which I'm sure the listeners heard before, was Get Your Tits Out for the Lads. We all know this chant, I'm sure. A lot of women have had it screamed at them. And you talked about being in Portugal, and that's what inspired this. Can you talk about how the title of the book came to be?
Sure. So Get Your Tits Out for the Lads is sadly still a chant that is said predominantly in England from men to women at football stadiums. And I was in Portugal for UEFA Euro 2004 with a group of friends, one female, some boys. And we were supporting England. The boys went ahead to a bar and my friend and I said we'd meet them there later. And that time came and we had to cross the road to this bar to go and meet the boys. And we were very, as you can imagine, in the minority. The bar was dominated by men, and two guys noticed us waiting to cross the road and started this chant, Get Your Tits Out for the Lads. And, at that point, it was just two drunk guys shouting across the road, and we kind of were embarrassed, laughed, smiled, but just was concentrating on getting across the road safely. But from two, it went to three, to four, to five, to the entire bar, which I estimate was, I don't know, somewhere between 200 and 300 guys, all screaming, all looking at us, all eyes on us, at the top of their voices, beers aplenty, Get Your Tits Out for the Lads. So at the time, as I say, we were young, we smiled, we laughed. But if you reverse that and think of that situation the other way around, so imagine there's a group of women in a bar and there's two guys approaching. We're not going to ask them to get there for the ladies. So why is it okay to say it the other way around? It's not okay. And that's why I thought, let's put this as the title of the book. It's eye-catching. With my marketing and communication background, I know when a book's on a shelf, we need something that is going to stand out from the crowd. So it ticks that box too, in that when you walk into a bookshop and you see that, you're hopefully at least going to be drawn to it, pick it up, maybe read the back cover, and that might then entice you to buy it. So it had, there's a couple of reasons why I chose it. One is the story that I just told about Portugal. But the second one is, from a marketing and a communication perspective, it's memorable and it's eye-catching.
Nice. And so I'll just read out the bio for everyone listening. So Get Your Tits Out for the Lads is a story of one woman's journey into the masculine and rather enigmatic world of football. With a degree in psychology and a master's in business specializing in sport management, coupled with an impressive sport-focused vocational history, Sally thought she was reasonably well prepared to launch a career in football. If you want to laugh out loud, cry and say wow more than once, this story will give you that and more. It's a perfect book for those who would like real insight into what it's like to be an intelligent young woman working in a male-dominated world. I think that's spot on from what I've read about it. It's so relatable, and your accolades are huge, but there are so many experiences in this that I think women can relate to. What about from a male point of view, like what would you want a male to get from this, or how would you get a male to read it and engage with it and think? Because even this, us speaking now, I feel like men might listen to the first 10 minutes of this and go, oh, this isn't about me, because this is all about women and feminism and, you know, cue the eye roll.
That's a great question, because a few people have asked me in the last few days who the target audience is. Is it men? Is it women? Is it both? What age? as you said, the feedback I've received so far from those that have read it, it's a very easy read. I write in a very conversational style, or I try to. So it's just like I'm having a coffee or a chat with you. That's how I've always written. There is some research in there as well, mainly to back up my points, but it's quite a conversational, easy read. You can take it on holiday, probably finish it in 2 or 3 days. It's not a long book. It's not heavy in the sense of hard or complicated to understand it. It's very easy. And a lot of my female friends that have read it have said, you know what? I'm going to get my male partner to read this. He doesn't have a choice. He needs to understand. I want him to read this. This is such an easy read, and this is a great tool. I've been banging on about some of these things for so long, but as you said, after 2 minutes, he shuts me up or he's not interested anymore. And it's hard because I can't think like a man because I'm not a man, and they can't think like women because they're not women. We are fundamentally different, and we have to acknowledge that. So I don't expect men to be interested and fully understand every single page, every single anecdote. But if they can learn just a little bit about sexism and make them think or question or call it out once after a result of reading this book, then to me, I've hit the jackpot. If even just one person changes their perception of what sexism is, and also calls it out, then great. You know, I'm not David Beckham. I don't have a million followers. I can't really do much more than that with the skill set that I have. But I really hope that anyone that reads it passes it to a friend or tells them a little anecdote that explains what they've been trying to explain, or gives them the courage to speak up too, because a lot of women and men, whatever problems we have in life, our defense mechanism so often is to just put on a brave face, say we're fine, everything's okay, not talk about it, brush it under the carpet, and we keep calm and carry on. And that has a purpose, and I do it myself sometimes, you know, I'm guilty of it. But writing about the topic was very cathartic for me. It got it all out my system. It was good for my mental health. It allowed me to, if I couldn't find the courage to talk about it, at least it helped me in that I'd written about it, chapter closed, go to work the next day. And everyone has different tactics to deal with problems going on in their life. But I think that the women that read it, the men that read it, they can take one or two things from it and then pass the book on and encourage other males to read it. At the festival, an 18-year-old boy that was volunteering asked me that question too. How can I call sexism out to my mates? Because a few of them recently have seen the Matildas World Cup posters and said, oh, who wants to watch women's football? I'm not watching that. Whereas he was really passionate about it and wanted to watch it. But he didn't want to say to his mates, well, actually, I'm watching it. And so I said to him, why don't you try the reverse tactic on them and say, well, so if that was a poster about the Men's World Cup, would you say the same thing? No, they wouldn't. So why is it okay to say it about women? And he liked that. He said, I'm going to try that next time I see them at school. So I don't know if that will work. And I hope he doesn't get bullied as a result of standing up to these sexist teenagers. But again, it's probably not their fault. They just think they're being cool, saying, oh, you know, that's how they've seen something that gives them the idea that the Women's World Cup's rubbish and they shouldn't watch it, which is ridiculous.
Do you think there's it's an interesting conversation I have all the time with James and Sean, who own Rebuild, about the sports science and men having testosterone. So biologically, there is there's inequality because men have more testosterone, so they are stronger. Generally, like an average man will be stronger than a strong woman in our gym. In basketball, for example, the FIBA World Cup, the women's basketball is a different game to the men's. Like the style of it's different. And I love that. I love watching it because it's different. It's not the NBA, but it's more a team kind of style of play. But there is a conversation there, and a lot of people say, oh, well, men are stronger or better at sport or taller or fitter or faster, which on a biological level can be somewhat true. Not overall, obviously. What do you think about that opinion and how that plays into women's sport? And what would you say to those people?
Well, there is a great video out at the moment, which if you haven't watched, I suggest that everyone on this podcast that's listening watches. It's the French Federation's latest campaign with one of their sponsors, Orange, the telecoms company. And they have, I don't want to spoil it, but just Google it, watch it. And that will answer your question in some ways because it's incredible. It will definitely win every football advertising award there is to win, and rightly so, because it is fantastic. But back to your point around women and men being different. Yes, we have to acknowledge men are faster, men are stronger. Men's football, therefore, when you watch it, is faster. If you watch a men's Premier League game and then flick to a women's game, of course the women are going to be slower. The same way as a female 100-meter sprinter runs it slower than the male 100-meter sprinter. But you don't hear the commentator saying about the women, oh, she's a bit slow. But so often, women's football is criticized for being slow and boring. But as you said about basketball, women's football can be appreciated for many different reasons. And that might be a reason why some people adopt it. It's family friendly. You don't get all the hooliganism, alcoholism sometimes that is associated with men's football, the fights, the aggression. It's free flowing. There isn't as much diving, simulation that we often see in men's football. So there are different reasons to watch women's football. But we need to be careful because let's not degrade the ability of these powerful female athletes. They are tactically amazing. They score beautiful goals. They're powerful. They're strong. All those adjectives that we so commonly associate with men can be applied to the women's game too. But we have to acknowledge that we are different physiologically. And that's why, of course, they're going to run down the wing as a man faster than a woman. But so what? Doesn't mean you can't enjoy women's football. I grew up watching men's and women's tennis because, hey, guess what? Most of the time it's on at the same time. All the Opens have women's and men's matches throughout 2 weeks of competition. So I grew up loving both women's tennis and men's tennis. I grew up never seeing girls and women play football. So guess what now? I know way more about men's football than I do about women's football. I'm embarrassed going into this Women's World Cup that I can't name the full England squad, the women's squad. I can give you every single player in the men's squad, what team they're playing for, who's the one to watch. I know way more about the men's football team than I do about the women's football team.
Well, let's hope that changes after this World Cup then.
Yes, I'll try my best to swat up and change that myself. And it's getting easier with the media actually covering it more and feeding me the same level of information that they feed me about men's football. So I'm starting to see, you know, more coverage about other teams and players to watch and stats around players from other teams, which we just take for granted with men's football coverage. But it's changing slowly but surely.
And Sally, we're nearly done. What would you say are the big career highlights for you in your rather accomplished career thus far?
Well, I think securing a role at UEFA was definitely my career highlight in terms of, you know, loving football and it being in my DNA to work for the European governing body for the biggest sport on the planet and move to Switzerland from Australia was really special for me. And I was really excited when I got that job. And I guess the other big highlight, which I, as a woman, I'm quite humble about and I have to get used to talking about it, is I've just written a book. And I say that with a smile on my face, but believe me, it's not easy to write a book and get it published. So I guess equally, that's another huge accomplishment that I'm very proud of. And I'm not comfortable saying that. And that's ridiculous. As a woman, I feel like I should be just don't even mention it. But hey, can you imagine a guy that's written a book? You probably wouldn't shut up about it. Not all men, of course. I don't want to be stereotypical the other way, but it's so, yeah. So often as women, we don't shout about our successes, and I'm one of those. And I think being humble is a good trait. So I don't want to be over the top about it, but I need to recognize the achievement. It's not easy to write. And there's a saying that everyone has a book in them, which I believe, but not everyone writes it and does it. So they're two of the highlights of my career so far.
As a professional writer, I can confirm writing a book is a huge achievement, and so very well done on that one.
Thank you, Caitlin.
On our last note, what would you say to any women or young females listening to this that want to work or compete in the athletic space now?
Do it. It will be hard. It will be tough. You'll need to be resilient, but we need trailblazers and it's changing. And I, you know, the young generation of today, I've touched on it a little bit. Those perceptions are changing. And although I've shone a light on some terrible things that have happened, we can together collectively get those out of society. It's not just football. I've used football because that's my story, but football is generally a mirror of life because it's such a global sport. It's the biggest sport on the planet. So sexism is everywhere, no matter whether you work in business, politics, science. I've used football, as I say, because that's relevant to me. But I, you know, to women out there that have ambitions to work in sport, yes, you'll need to be resilient. You'll need to be tough, but stand up for yourself, be brave, get some allies and go forth and conquer. And we'll get equality soon.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Sally. Your book is on sale now. And where can people find you if they wanted to reach out to you?
They can follow me on Twitter at FriedmanSal. So my surname, FriedmanSal. I'm on Instagram, Sally Friedman. And the book is available via Fair Play Publishing and also on amazon.com.au.
And that's Get Your Tits Out for the Lads. Thank you so much for your time, Sally. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Caitlin. That was great.